Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Religious Liberties Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, June 1st, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call, as today we discuss litigation under the Civil Rights Act. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome two experts today. One is going to, they're both going to give opening remarks. We'll hear first from Professor Anthony Michael Kreiss. He's the Visiting Assistant Professor of Law at the Chicago Kent College of Law. He's going to give opening remarks after giving us a little bit of background on the case, and he'll be followed by Kenneth A. Klukowski. He's General Counsel of the American Civil Rights Union. But as always, after the opening remarks, we'll be looking to the audience for questions, so please have those in mind for when we get to that part of the program. With that, Professor Kreiss, the floor is yours.
So I'll give a little background on the 11th Circuit and the 7th Circuit cases and where the law is may or may not be going. So the 11th Circuit case is Evans versus Georgia Regional Hospital. And there, the plaintiff, Jamaica Evans, she was a security guard at a hospital in Savannah, Georgia. She is a lesbian, never discussed her sexuality at work, but her clothing and hairstyle were generally masculine in nature, and she claimed in her lawsuit that she had been harassed and penalized because of her masculine characteristics and the fact that she was a lesbian or is a lesbian. And she claimed that the hostile work environment between her masculine appearance and her sexual orientation constituted what gave rise to her to the hostile work environment was the fact that she didn't conform with a traditional expectations of what a woman acts and looks like. And so Evans filed a Title VII claim, which is, of course, is a federal employment discrimination claim, alleging that she was discriminated against because of her sex. And Title VII, of course, prohibits employers from discriminating against employees on the basis of sex. And there's a key landmark decision from 1989 in the Supreme Court in Price Waterhouse versus Hopkins, where the court, in a plurality opinion, reasoned that under Title VII, gender must be irrelevant to employment decisions, and that includes sex stereotyping. So, if an employer acts on the basis of a belief that a woman can't be aggressive or she must be exceptionally feminine, that is also gender-based discrimination and is thus prohibited under Title VII. The Seventh Circuit, I think, summarized it exceptionally well in a case called Doe versus City of Belleville, where they said Title VII doesn't permit an employee to be treated adversely because of his or her appearance or conduct does not conform to stereotypical gender norms. Now, in Jamaica Evans' case, the magistrate judge issued a report and recommendation to dismiss the suit because, in fact, she was really claiming a sexual orientation claim, and Title VII only prohibits sex-based discrimination claims. On appeal, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed the dismissal 2-1, and they cited a 1979 case, Blum versus the Oil Gulf Corporation. Now, the Blum case is a Fifth Circuit case, but is binding on the 11th Circuit, and it was, generally speaking, it was a pretty perfunctory analysis of whether sex discrimination includes sexual orientation discrimination. And in that sense, it wasn't particularly extraordinary, but it reaffirmed the circuit precedent that sexual orientation claims weren't colorable under Title VII. And that's generally been the case in most circuit courts of appeals, which have held on to a longstanding precedent that sexual orientation discrimination claims are not colorable under Title VII's existing framework. That is, of course, until the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Hively versus Ivy Tech ruled that sex discrimination is also inclusive of sexual orientation discrimination. And the court reasoned that under the Supreme Court's test for sex discrimination, which is articulated in the L.A. Department of Water and Power versus Manhart, that the simple test is whether a person's the disparate treatment was but for that person's sex. So in the sexual orientation context, this is probably easy to show or illustrate when an employer has a disapproves or treats unequally an employee in a same-sex relationship. So if an employer mistreats a female worker because she has an intimate relationship with another woman, but the employer would not mistreat the employee if she had a substantially similar relationship with a man, that would be but-for causation that she was discriminated on the basis of sex. There's a really, I think, a good case that illustrates this from Washington State. An employer denied health care benefits to married same-sex couples that were otherwise provided to married opposite-sex couples. The company moved to dismiss the Title VII sex discrimination claim, arguing that effectively the thrust of the claim was a sexual orientation discrimination claim and not prohibited under federal law. And the court denied that, saying no, it was sex discrimination because if the plaintiffs had been married to a person of the opposite sex, not the same sex, they would not have been treated differently. Now, I think this is important to put in a more general constitutional context, because of course Title VII in many ways mirrors the constitutional protections, and a number of courts have found that blocking marriage rights has constituted sex discrimination. In fact, Chief Justice Roberts mentioned that in his in oral arguments for the marriage cases in Obergefell. And so in Hively, the court held that that simple but-for test is satisfied when in this particular context, because but-for, if the plaintiff had been in a relationship with a person of the opposite sex, it is inherently about sex, and therefore Title VII covers sexual orientation discrimination claims. The second rationale for in the Hively decision comes from Price Waterhouse, which again says that sexual orientation, says that gender nonconformity is protected, and so if a employer engages in adverse employment action against an employee because of sex stereotypes, that is a colorable claim under Title VII. And what the Seventh Circuit ultimately said is that sexual orientation is inherently the most prototypical form of sex stereotyping animus, and that homosexuality is the ultimate gender nonconformity, and that in society we expect people, generally speaking, to be heterosexuals and to enter opposite sex relationships, and so those individuals who are attracted to people of the same sex run against the grain of society's expectations that people should be in opposite sex relationships. The third case, or the third rationale that was employed in the Hively decision, was an associational-based claim. In the Second Circuit and the Eleventh Circuit, there have been, or the circuit courts have recognized that individuals have Title VII claims based on their more intimate associations. The landmark case was in New York, called Whitney versus Greater New York Corporation for Seventh-day Adventists. And the Eleventh Circuit case is Parr versus Woodman. In that case, I think that the Parr case illustrates what the associational claims look like generally. So Don Parr, at the time, applied for an insurance salesman position. He was not hired after the company became aware he was in an interracial marriage. The district court at the time granted the company's motion to dismiss because Parr was not discriminated against because of his race. Don Parr was white, and the individuals that were trying to hire him or that were interviewing him were also white, and so they weren't discriminating against him because he was white, but they were, in fact, really discriminating against his relationship and projecting animus towards his non-white wife. But the circuit court reversed the district court, and they said that Title VII prescribes race-conscious discriminatory practices, and that includes the associational relationship, the marriage, and Title VII protects that relationship as well. The Second Circuit has recognized that, and the Seventh Circuit said that that also applies to same-sex couples. And so the associational relationship between a married same-sex couple or a same-sex couple in an intimate relationship must be afforded that protection. Now, taken together, of course, these three rationales, I think, are fairly strong. There's a strong textual argument here. The associational claims, I think, makes good sense. The gender nonconformity claims, I think, also make a good deal of sense as well. And I think we will see courts increasingly more comfortable with adopting all these three principles and applying Title VII's protections under sex discrimination protections to gays, lesbians, bisexuals. So the current state of the law, of course, the Seventh Circuit is the only circuit to have fully embraced this position that sexual orientation claims are colorable under Title VII. The Second Circuit has recently granted en banc in a case called Zarda, and I think I expect the Second Circuit to follow the Seventh Circuit's lead here. The Second Circuit had an earlier case by the name of Christensen. Christensen had a actionable, very standard gender nonconformity claim that didn't rely or didn't need the court to overturn existing precedent stating that sexual orientation claims weren't colorable under Title VII. And so that wasn't a particularly great vehicle for overturning circuit precedent. But the Second Circuit's opinion was included a concurring opinion from Chief Judge Katzmann, who all but endorsed the Seventh Circuit's rationale in Hively and effectively called for the court to reconsider precedent en banc. And so that is exactly what the court has done. The Eleventh Circuit's decision upholding the magistrate court's or the magistrate judge's recommendation that the claim, Jamaica Evans' claim, be dismissed because sexual orientation is not covered under Title VII. There has been a petition filed to rehear that en banc, but no action has been taken by the court quite yet. And so it'll be quite interesting to see how these things unfold. But I think the thrust of these decisions shows that the law is rapidly evolving in embracing these sexual orientation discrimination claims and treating them much more favorably, and I anticipate that we'll see many more courts following the Seventh Circuit's lead. The Eleventh Circuit will truly, I think, be a bellwether here. I suspect that the writing is on the wall in the Second Circuit, but time will tell with that. And with that, I'll turn it over to Ken.
Well, thank you, Professor, and appreciate very much your comments. As my friend said, this case recently came down from the Seventh Circuit sitting en banc. It was an 8-3 decision. The focus here being on Title VII, which prohibits discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. That's a 1964 statute. Now, for years, there was debate about changing the statute to add additional specially protected categories, most commonly sexual orientation and gender identity. All of those legislative attempts, such as ENDA, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, have failed. They have not gotten through Congress. And then in 2015, the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, decided that it was not necessary to change the statute because the term sex in Title VII already includes sexual orientation and gender identity, and thus that it's unnecessary to change the statute to do that. Now, one area where all the judges on the Seventh Circuit agreed is that all of them agreed, all 11 agreed that they should not defer to the interpretation of the EEOC on this matter, that it's a question of first impression and one where they would review anything that's come previously de novo. Now, looking at their own precedents, in Hamner versus St. Vincent's Hospital, a 2000 case from the Seventh Circuit, the circuit had categorically held that Title VII does not include sexual orientation as a basis for discrimination. And that was the controlling precedent. That and a line of other cases were the controlling precedents that the panel here invoked when they affirmed dismissal under the district court's dismissal under Rule 12b-6 for failure to state a claim. The panel there was Rovner, Bauer, and Ripple, so you have an ideologically diverse panel, but everyone acknowledged that this was the law of the circuit. Now, sitting en banc and reconsidering Hamner and the entire line of cases involved in it, the majority here, the opinion being written by Chief Judge Diane Wood, the majority cites Price Waterhouse versus Hopkins, the 1989 6-3 decision, where Justice Brennan wrote the plurality opinion for the court, pertaining, of course, to the gender stereotyping language that my friend just referenced. Now, applying Price Waterhouse here, the Chief Judge Wood and her fellow majority judges said that that laws or government actions, or in fact, in this case, private actions, employer actions, differentiating on the basis of sexual orientation, they called the sine qua non of a gender stereotype. And then the language is perhaps in some regards circular in terms of they define it in such a way that it inexorably leads to that conclusion. Certainly in a way where neither the dissent nor anyone else would be able to object. And as Judge Wood put it, she said, the question before us is not whether this court can or should amend Title VII. She goes on later to say, obviously, that lies beyond our power. But then she goes on to say they're putting no stock in the non-passage of ENDA and other proposed legislative fixes, saying that the fact that, and in fact, I think it was interesting to have this lineup of judges saying it. I think for some of the judges who joined this majority opinion, it's the first time I've seen them suggest that legislative history did not matter in terms of how they were choosing to interpret the text. The court there also cites to Uncalle versus Sundowner Offshore Services, a 1998 9-0 opinion written by Justice Scalia. It's not necessarily unanimous. Justice Thomas wrote an opinion concurring in the judgment, but all nine of the justices on the same side. And looking to an earlier line of cases, especially Meritor Savings Bank versus Vinson from 1986, they acknowledged in 1986 that sexual harassment is encompassed within sex discrimination for purposes of Title VII. Then in Uncalle in 1998, it involved the case of a man who was sexually harassing another man. And the court there, as I said, without dissent, held that sexual harassment prohibitions would extend to harassing a person of the same sex. And so taking this line of cases together and then invoking Obergefell at the end, they just simply say that that discriminating on the basis of sexual orientation is no different, is in fact literally part of discriminating on the basis of sex, and therefore overruling the prior precedents, reversed the district court. Now, there were four opinions in the case. Judge Posner joined the majority opinion, but also wrote his own separate opinion, in which I think what the most revealing passage is where he says, I would prefer to see us acknowledge openly that today we, who are judges rather than members of Congress, are imposing on a half-century-old statute a meaning of sex discrimination that the Congress that enacted it would not have accepted. And then having made that bold declaration, he goes on to say flat out, no, this was not sex in 1964 when Title VII was adopted, but we've come to understand new things over the past half century, and we are reading these enlightened views into the text. Judge Flom and Ripple also issued a separate concurring opinion, which I'm not going to take the time to go into here in the interests of time. And then we move over to the dissent, written by Judge Sykes, joined by Judges Bauer and Caney. And I think the theory that I would put on the case on this is that this is a case about positive law and the separation of powers, not about LGBT issues. And I'll start by just quoting a passage from Judge Sykes' dissent, where she says that that equating sex with sexual orientation, she said, quote, neither is faithful to the statutory text, read fairly, as a reasonable person would have understood it when it was adopted. The result is a statutory amendment courtesy of unelected judges. Judge Posner admits this. He embraces and argues for this conception of judicial power. The majority does not, preferring instead to smuggle in the statutory amendment under cover of an aggressive reading of loosely related Supreme Court precedents. Either way, the result is the same, the circumvention of the legislative process by which the people govern themselves. She later goes on to explain that the only legitimate way to interpret language in a statute is that, quote, language is that you must interpret, quote, language as a reasonable person would have understood it at the time of enactment. So for her, this is quite simple. The question is, did the term sex mean in 1964 sexual orientation? And she goes on to say, that describing what the majority has done is saying that we have the discretion to ascribe to Title VII a meaning that it did not bear at its inception. Now, Judge Sykes goes on to acknowledge that there are common law statutes. She cites the Sherman Act as a perfect example, but says that in those statutes, Congress gave clear indicia that it was empowering the courts to actually flesh out the subject matter as state courts can do in a common law fashion, making policy through decisional law. But goes on to say that Title VII is not one of them, therefore that this is a pure statutory interpretation case. Later on in the opinion, she says, when we assume the power to alter the original public meaning of a statute through the process of interpretation, we assume a power that is not ours. The Constitution assigns that power to make and amend statutory law to the elected representatives of the people. Now, she then surveys the other circuits and notes that the majority had done the same thing, and concludes, as the majority did, that all circuits agree that sexual orientation discrimination is a distinct form of discrimination that is not synonymous with sex discrimination. And that, of course, is why the proponents of adding sexual orientation as a protected category under Title VII, and for that matter, Title IX and other parts of federal law, have sought to do so through the legislative process. No one was starting with the assumption that it was unnecessary because it was already illegal if only we could get it before a court that was smart enough to understand the meanings of these terms. Now, she then goes on to also discuss the difference between original intent and original meaning, and uses that to explain cases like the unanimous Uncalle decision from 1998, where, sure, there was absolutely no question that in 1964, Congress was not thinking of homosexual harassment in the workplace when they mentioned sex as a protected category under Title VII. But she goes on to make the case that even though they were not thinking about it, even though Congress was not contemplating it in 1964, that in no way makes the 1998 decision invalid, and conversely does not mean that the 1998 decision reinforces what the majority sitting en banc did so in this case, in that she said the issue was what is the meaning of sex, and that the court in 1986 in Meritor had said that sex discrimination does include sex harassment, that that's part of the meaning encompassed in sex discrimination. And thus, in 1998, that sexual harassment, that is making unwanted sexual advances on another person, is still illegal under the 1964 statute, regardless if the person you're harassing is the opposite biological sex or the same biological sex, and thus that it's consistent with the original meaning of Title VII, that sexual harassment of a person of the same sex would be illegal under the original meaning of the statute. But then she goes on to say that the two terms are never used interchangeably, referring to positive law, and that the latter is not subsumed within the former. There is no overlap in meaning. She goes on to note that VAWA, the Violence Against Women Act, also the Federal Hate Crimes Act, are federal statutes where it specifically lists sex and sexual orientation as separate prohibited categories, and then also surveys state and local statutes which do the same. And she rejects the idea that it is actually, in the words of the majority, that it is actually impossible to discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation without discriminating on the basis of sex, pointing out that an employer who refuses to hire a person because they're homosexual is discriminating against people equally, regardless of whether it's a homosexual man or a homosexual woman, that the sex of the person applying makes no difference. It's the orientation of that person that is that's being targeted. Now, I'll close with two very brief points. One is that there are profound religious liberty implications regarding this subject matter. Religious liberty does not come up in this case, but it's a safe bet that there will be a great many cases that could arise from this decision. The court here explicitly disclaims any ruling on a religious liberty issue, acknowledging that it could come up in another context. And the second is to say that having adopted this meaning in Title VII, there's automatic implications for other areas of law. And in fact, the other shoe dropped just this week with this same court, where a three-judge panel of the Seventh Circuit just held on May 30th in Whitaker versus Kenosha Unified School District, it's a case out at the Eastern District of Wisconsin, that the same meaning in Title VII also applies to Title IX, and thus held regarding not just sexual orientation, but also gender identity, and ruled in favor of a transgender individual in a school system in Wisconsin, but then went the extra step, which I think surprised a lot of people, having decided that case on statutory grounds. They also then went past Title IX and ruled that the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment also adopts these meanings, and therefore that transgender and presumably sexual orientation are actually required under not just Title IX, but presumably also Title VII, but then all government actions under the 14th Amendment. I think that's certainly a huge decision, and one that I think has the potential for Supreme Court review written all over it. And with that, with having looked at the broader picture there, go ahead and turn things over to Dean again with great thankfulness for having us today.
Well, thank you both. Sweeping set of opening remarks from each of you. I appreciate that. Let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the pound button, the star button, and then the pound button on your phone. Sorry. So if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Before we jump in with audience questions, a quick announcement about our next scheduled Teleforum conference call. That's tomorrow at 2 p.m. at this same number, 2 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll be talking about the D.C. Circuit Court's net neutrality case. Again, if you have a question today, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending, then our lines will be wide open. Let's take our first call.
Yeah, I was interested if you could talk a little bit about when Judge Sykes speaks in the dissent about the evidentiary issues that juries are likely to face in confronting homosexual discrimination as gender discrimination. And she, I think she gives an example of a position or an employer who employs many women but won't employ a homosexual woman, and that a jury has to find that that is in fact sex discrimination. Do you see there being particular issues here, or is our jury system ready to do this?
Anthony, I've been talking for quite a while. Do you want to start with that one?
Yeah, I'll take a stab at it. I think in when you can set it up and describe to a jury that it's a but-for causation, that if, in this particular example, if a woman who is in a relationship with another woman would not have been discriminated against if she was in a relationship with a man, and if the evidence shows that that's the case, that's sex discrimination. I know Judge Sykes made much to do about comparators and the evidentiary problems that this poses, but I think that that's not. I don't really think that that's a major concern, at least on my end. I think the juries are quite capable of isolating that one particular factor and looking and evaluating the evidence accordingly, and rendering good decisions based on the evidence presented.
Yeah, I think what I would add to that is the point there, and I'm trying to remember if we covered this in our description of the case, is that here you have a woman who's working part-time at Ivy Tech, which is a public university in the state of Indiana, and she had repeatedly applied for a full-time position. She was unsuccessful in each of those attempts, and after several years, they also told her that they would not be renewing her part-time position going forward. That's where she sued. In the district court, she was pro se. She was represented by Lambda Legal on appeal, but represented herself pro se and was claiming that this was a form of sex discrimination. I think what Judge Sykes was saying is to say that the law was being defined in such a way that it would almost handcuff a jury, where she said, let's say this goes back down and this actually goes to a jury, and let's say that it becomes clear that Ivy Tech has recently hired a whole host of women for full-time positions. She said, the way that this opinion is coming down today, it's like the jury would not be able to read that as evidence, would not be allowed from that to find that what was going on in Ms. Hively's case was not a form of sex discrimination, because the sexual orientation almost in a way sets it apart in its own category, where normal indicia or normal evidence of finding sex discrimination couldn't come into play. To take it to a more extreme extent, if they had only hired women for full-time positions over the past, let's say, 2 years, Judge Sykes was taking issue that nonetheless they could still be found liable by a jury for sex discrimination. And I think she was using that to point out that sex cannot mean sexual orientation, because the evidence that we normally look to conclude that someone has engaged, as a factual matter, in sex discrimination would not lead to the same result here.
Yeah, I would just say that the other thing I would add is I think Pricewaterhouse is instructive here. So if a company hires a handful of women, but won't hire the woman who is less feminine than the others, right? So she demonstrates more masculine traits. Juries are quite capable of saying, well, we can isolate the one factor here, and that's the sex stereotyping, that's the gender nonconformity, and we can progress accordingly. So I mean, from my perspective, the gender nonconformity, sex stereotyping types of claims that emanate from Pricewaterhouse really push back against that concern.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending, then our lines will be wide open. Let me see if I can slip in a question here. And that's, you both mentioned, one or the other of you mentioned, the fact that Chief Judge Diane Wood is asserting in her opinion that they're not rewriting or amending the statute, which I think is not a surprising thing to say in the majority opinion. In contrast, Judge Diane Sykes say this does amount to a revision or an amendment to the statute. Also very maybe not surprising. But then Judge Posner, in the majority, with the majority, I guess in a concurring opinion, says that this does amount to, and he embraces the idea of revising the statute or rewriting the statute. The question is, what does that mean for a potential Supreme Court case? Is that going to weigh on anybody's minds if this case goes forward?
In my mind, I guess I'll jump in first on this one. In my mind, it should. And first of all, I want to give Judge Posner credit here for honesty. I mean, he's being completely candid. And I think it is, as Judge Sykes explained in her dissent, she said Judge Posner is being open about this. He admits this. In fact, he embraces it. The majority is slipping it in quietly, refusing to admit this, but citing a bunch of loosely related Supreme Court cases to do what, in fact, Judge Posner is doing, and that is Congress has debated this. Congress has decided not to do it, that for people who are fluent in the English language, they know that these terms are separate. They understand and acknowledge the political push to amend the statute to add new categories, and she says, you know, perhaps that's even a good policy question, but that is most certainly lawmaking. And so I think in terms of the cert worthiness of this case, I think that that does highlight it, because that's why I said at the outset, I do not see this as an LGBT case. I see this as a separation of powers case, and even more broadly, a positive law case. The issue of why do we have written law at all? I mean, it's many lawyers, you know, where we don't have to deal with issues in the 1700s, certainly many history students, many school students, are not taught that, in a way, the most revolutionary thing about the American Revolution is that at the conclusion of it, we actually adopted a written constitution, that there were countries like England that cited their constitution, but we were the first nation in world history that said, we're actually going to have a written constitution so that everyone knows what it says and what it doesn't say, and that our whole statutory legal system, as opposed to a common law system, is predicated on exactly that same concept, that you go through a democratic process to reduce words to writing, and those words are the law. And I think the implications of this case in that regard are really quite noteworthy.
Professor Kreis?
Yeah, so, you know, Judge Posner's a colorful character. I think there's a lot of really great academic interest in his concurring opinion. But of course, it was a single concurring opinion, and none of the other judges in the majority opted to join him. And I think that certainly diminishes the weight of it. Perhaps if this case was bound for the Supreme Court without other circuits weighing in the interim, that opinion I think might weigh much more heavily in favor of some of the folks who are opposed to the judgment in this case. But I think if and when this ever comes to the Supreme Court in the near term, you will have more decisions from the Second Circuit, perhaps the 11th Circuit, other circuits, other district courts, that I think will certainly add a much more balanced and a very large a large data set, for lack of a better phrase, for the court to look at. And frankly, you know, certainly there's a lot in that Judge Posner's concurring opinion which I think could be cherry-picked and quoted and used in an opinion to reverse a decision from a court of appeals saying holding that sexual orientation claims are colorable under Title VII. But I don't think it's ultimately going to have a lot of impact on what the court, the Supreme Court, ultimately does if a case gets there in the near term.
Once again, if you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Two questions pending. Let's take another call.
Thank you for this discussion. I wanted to raise a question about whether there is a clear legal definition of what being transgendered is. It seems to me that it can range from Caitlyn Jenner, who has extensive surgery and a complete life change, to the young person in the Kenosha school who had some hormonal therapy but hadn't gone through much else, to people who are colloquially called gender benders, who like to appear either as cross-dressers or in other ways as persons of the opposite sex on different occasions, but not every day. So if persons can claim to be transgendered and then enjoy or use facilities for not their biological sex, is there any steps that they have to take that grants them legal protection, or can they just claim a transgendered identity whenever it suits them?
It's the latter. That there are no legal constraints on that right now. I've heard isolated discussions of trying to adopt criteria, but because there is so much elasticity in it, those who are considering constraints are actually concerned that any such constraints would result in litigation. You have first the concept of gender fluidity, and that is that my gender can change on an ongoing basis, perhaps even on a daily basis. The other is that it's a matter of pure identity, meaning a matter of self-identification. Therefore, it imposes, for those who accept that legal theory, it opposes an illegal constraint to say that you must manifest that identity through particular clothing or through, to say nothing of actions that are more invasive, such as surgery or hormone treatments. And that was why many people were saying that under the transgender guidance put forward as the Dear Colleague letter from DOJ and the Education Department in the final period of the Obama administration, that there would be 17-year-old high school males who would be high-fiving each other just to say, yeah, I'm identifying as a girl, and walking into the girl's shower after one of the girls' sports teams had finished their event. Since by the wording of that guidance that was issued, the schools were, there were school systems expressing grave alarm that they saw no way that they could seek to impede that sort of behavior without running afoul of potential adverse action in that case from the federal government. So there are no constraints, at least, that are recognized at this time.
May I follow up with a very short question?
Let me ask Professor Kreis if he wants to jump in here first.
Yeah. So two things. Well, first off, from the onset, in the sense of Title VII, transgender individuals have been protected in numerous circuit courts under Title VII, and in fact, the 11th Circuit under the Equal Protection Clause for quite some time. And that, I mean, there was a landmark case in the 11th Circuit that Judge William Pryor even signed on to, protecting a transgender individual under the Equal Protection Clause, and that's the Glenn versus Brumby case. So that's a distinct issue, I think, from sexual orientation. I mean, they're similar in a lot of ways, but they're distinct issues. In terms, however, of how we, you know, what standards apply, first off, there are different standards for minors than there are for adults, because for minors, surgery, for example, is not generally a medically accepted practice or standard of care for minors, and so there's different standards that apply. For the most part, when students who are transgender want the school to recognize their gender identity, it is not it's generally not a process where the student just says one day, I'm transgender, and the school respects it and doesn't question it. There is consultation. Parents are involved. Administrators are involved. So the likelihood of a 17-year-old boy deciding one day that he's going to take advantage of transgender accommodations, I think, is incredibly unlikely. And there's other issues in terms of adults and how birth certificates work, and that's a whole another conversation, I think, for another day. But there are generally the trend is that the state should at least recognize that there are accepted medical practices, and we should defer to those medical practices. But again, I think that's a whole other conversation for another day. That's again tangentially related to the Title VII conversation, but is a distinct one from the Hively case.
We do have a couple other questions pending. Caller, if you want to have a follow-up, why don't you try and ring back in after we move on to the next caller? If we have time, we'll come back around to you.
Fair enough.
Let's head now to our next caller.
Is there any movement to impeach Judge Posner, who, by the way, taught me many, many years ago at the University of Chicago, for his blatant stand to go beyond what should be the powers of the judiciary? Is there any movement to cite his explanation of what he's doing in questioning of future judge candidates when they come up before the Senate?
That's maybe a bit far afield from this case, but did anybody want to take a shot at that?
I'm not aware of any such movement. In fact, I'm actually not even sure that there's been any movement in Congress to even attempt to overturn this decision by some form of legislation. So. I think for the most part, it's remarkably, I don't want to say flown under the radar, but it hasn't really been at the forefront of any robust political conversations that I'm aware of, at least.
Yeah, I'm not aware of any such movement either, nor would I support one. I think that Judge Posner was forthrightly setting forth what is a widely held view of judicial power. Now, it's one that I don't agree with. But for more than two centuries, we have not considered it where the Constitution specifies that federal judges hold their offices during time of good behavior. That good behavior language has always been construed to mean that it's only violated for serious criminal conduct, usually felonies and usually a conviction. And that we don't just remove judges, that this is not a de facto parliamentary system of government. I mean, under that same rationale, we could just impeach and remove a president every time he does something we don't like, since Congress can decide what high crimes and misdemeanors mean. So I think from a separation of powers and a checks and balances standpoint, Judge Posner's view is honestly held by a great many judges on the liberal end of the judicial spectrum. And I think people who oppose it should work hard to win the presidency and a Senate majority that holds a different view of judicial power, not just destroying life-tenured judges they disagree with. Because I think, among other things, I think that the political left tends to use a tool like that more than the right. And I think if that becomes the norm, you would see attempts to take out Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito and countless other justices and judges, and it would become a free-for-all, and I think it would ultimately be a chaotic situation.
Moving right on, we've got a couple questions pending. Let's take another call.
I apologize for jumping on to the Judge Posner bandwagon, but my question is there something disingenuous with him trying to justify his concurrence on the basis that, you know, Congress needs the judiciary to bring old statutes into the modern age, whereas, as you talked about, there were plenty of attempts in Congress to update this statute to include just the sort of discrimination that the Seventh Circuit extended the definition to entail? I mean, how can he justify it on that basis when Congress had the chance to act and chose not to.
Either of our experts want to weigh in here?
I'll take a step. I first off, of course, I don't really put a lot of weight on Judge Posner's concurrence. I think for me, it's just more interesting as an academic than anything else. Although I think that there is kernels of truth to what he said that no one would want to probably admit. I think in terms of congressional inaction, I think that a clear, plain reading of the text and the but-for test makes it, I think, is a compelling case on its own that sexual orientation claims are colorable under Title VII. And I think that it's just not been recognized for quite some time. Of course, Judge Posner has articulated to some extent, about how some of these common law like statutes, like the Sherman Antitrust Act, and try to justify the updating kind of through the lens of that. But again, I just don't put a heck of a lot of stock in what one judge's perspective is on that front. I think time will tell, and I'm more interested to see what the Second Circuit does, what the Eleventh Circuit does, and then perhaps being able to flesh out maybe a better understanding, maybe not a better understanding, but to see Judge Posner's rationale not only alongside with other folk, the other judges on the Seventh Circuit, to see more opinions, majority opinions, concurring opinions, dissenting opinions, and put it in a broader context. And I think that we'll learn perhaps more from it in that broader light.
I think I have a different view of it. I think that this is part of a much broader trend. This doesn't just have to do with Title VII or Title IX. I think we see it in Obergefell, but to get out of any context involving sexual matters, it's what you see in the whole line of cases with Roe v. Wade. It's if I believe something should be legal or illegal, I'm going to interpret the extant text, whether it be statutory or constitutional, to say that it's already represented there. And I think it also the converse is also true. I think we also see provisions that are in the Constitution that are disfavored in some circles and are read to have no meaning or very little meaning. And the archetype of that would be the Second Amendment with D.C. v. Heller, where you had four justices who looked at the words, the operative words of the Second Amendment, and say, "Yeah, this doesn't apply to people at all. No one has a right to own a gun." And in a series of subsequent circuit court cases that we've seen, have read Heller and its accompanying incorporating case McDonald in very, very narrow terms, to where there are some circuits where the Second Amendment only means that a law-abiding adult citizen can own a handgun, possibly with a permit, in their own privately owned residence, but that it doesn't extend to other types of weapons or walking outside your home or having multiple weapons or whatnot. So I think that, once again, this comes to an issue of why we have written law and comes to the issue of separation of power. So I think the implications of it, I think it's the tip of an iceberg, and it's a very large iceberg.
Looks like we have a final question. I'm going to ask the caller to be as concise as possible, so if we see if we can get through this final question. Go ahead, caller.
We're in early days of transgendered law, but what would stand in the way of a high school boy deciding that he wants to play on a field hockey or softball team because that is his current identity?
That's actually happening, and we had a couple biological males just win state championships in female sports. I've seen news reports on that, because lo and behold, it turned out that he had larger physical size and larger muscle mass and ended up actually winning the race. So first of all, not only is there no impediment, it's actually happening right now. But in the last seconds we have, I'll also just throw in as something that could be a whole nother discussion, is that all of this discussion has been a binary gender conception of male or female. I mean, there's a case in Colorado right now of a man who does not identify as either, calls himself intersex, and has sued the State Department to issue him a passport that does not identify him as either male or female. So, I mean, so this really is a much broader issue, and there's a broad spectrum of issues beyond the conception of even, obviously, the axioms that we based today's current discussion on.
I think, quite frankly, that local high school athletic associations are equipped to handle these kinds of situations. And I think that just as high schools and are equipped and able to accommodate students based on their gender identity for restrooms and changing facilities and pronoun usage and all the rest, that there are ways to accommodate these individuals in a way that respects their gender identity and in a way that's thoughtful and comprehensive. I think, again, that's a whole other issue for another day, and it's something that I think requires thoughtful consultation with medical professionals and educational administrators and all the rest to get policies in place that can do that kind of work. But again, I will emphasize again that I think that is, of course, a conversation for another day, right? Because Title VII, the conversation, with Hively is really about sexual orientation, and there's actually quite a bit more case law on transgender rights and transgender protections than there are on a federal basis than there are sexual orientation in terms of statutory law. And again, that could be a whole conversation for another day. But I think that there is a way that individuals can be accommodated in a way that's thoughtful and comprehensive.
Well, very good, gentlemen. I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it right there. We're out of time, and we're also out of questions, happily. So I want to thank both our guests, Professor Kreis and Ken Klukowski, for joining us today. I also want to thank the audience for dialing in and for your thoughtful questions. A reminder to our audience about our next scheduled Teleforum conference call. It's tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. This same number, we'll be talking about net neutrality. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.